This is the Takeaway Podcast for May 17th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And perhaps a theme of the outgoing Obama administration might be something like mission not accomplished or mission nebulous. Here is the president speaking to U.S. troops at Fort Bragg in 2011 about ending the war in Iraq and lessons learned.
It's harder to end a war than begin one. Indeed, everything that American troops have done in Iraq, all the fighting and all the dying, the bleeding and the building and the training and the partnering, all of it has led to this moment of success.
We know, of course, what happened to that moment of success, the dreamed of peace in Iraq. But what of other conflicts? Secretary of State John Kerry is in Vienna this week to meet with foreign ministers, and he wants to end a UN arms embargo to Libya imposed in 2011. Here's Secretary Kerry speaking on Monday in Vienna.
The arms embargo does allow for the government of national accord to request weapons if it needs them specifically to secure the country and to combat Daesh.
Kerry wants U.S. weapons in the war against Daesh or ISIS. Does this arrangement mean U.S. boots on the ground?
We're not talking about troops and boots and that kind of intervention. We're simply in a mode of trying to help and assist and develop a Libyan capacity to be able to respond to the challenge of security within Libya.
Maybe the reason Secretary Kerry said that is that he knows the U.S. already has boots on the ground in Libya. The Washington Post reported last week that two special operations units totaling about 25 people have been stationed in eastern and western Libya since late 2015. There are quite a few boots on the ground in Africa, it turns out. A conference this month in Tanzania confirmed that there are U.S. troops in Uganda, maritime forces in Senegal, troops at a huge base in Djibouti, forces in Ethiopia and Somalia, Burundi, Mauritania. And that's part of a much larger push under President Obama to increase special ops units in Africa to the point where the U.S. military is now involved in over 90% of Africa's 54 countries. A lot of what we know about U.S. forces in Africa comes from the work of Nick Turse, who's author of Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. Nick Turse, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Also here is William Wexler, who oversaw special operations from the Pentagon during the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism from 2012 to 2015. He's now a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. William Wexler, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
William, can I just ask you if generally the scale of what we think are the operations in Africa sounds correct to you? Is it fundamentally different from what went on in the Cold War? Am I characterizing this, close to bullseye here?
I think in general, your characterization is correct, but it might be misinterpreted by people listening. The vast majority of the work that's being done is simple training and liaison work, and that kind of work goes on in country after country around the world and has gone on for decades and decades. What's different about what's going on right now is the common threat that many of these countries are feeling from Salafi jihadists, whether it's al-Qaeda or whether it's Ansar al-Sharia or whether it's the Islamic State.
But isn't it the case that if those threats become more real, then those troops are right there to be activated and with prepositioned equipment and materiel and communications gear operating from Djibouti, boom, we're in a conflict.
It's certainly possible and certainly something that you have to worry about, but it's unlikely. The fundamental question that that policymakers need to ask themselves is whether sending a small detachment of special operations forces to do the equipping and training and advising and assisting work to help other countries fight their own fight against terrorists is something that prevents the United States from being in a real conflict, or something that is the slippery slope to getting the United States in such a conflict. People who see the world through the Vietnam lens have ample reason to worry about the slippery slope thesis. But our more recent experience shows otherwise, as we've seen in Colombia, as we've seen in the Philippines, as we've seen on the African continent itself in the last number of years. There have been good experiences that we've had where properly managed, properly overseen, very small deployments of special operations forces actually keep the United States out of such a conflict by enabling the local countries to fight their own wars.
All right, William Wexler, I'm going to come back to you on that precise issue there, but let's get a sense from Nick Turse. What do you think of the scale of U.S. involvement in Africa as you've managed to report this? And we're relying on your numbers here.
Sure. I mean, we've seen exponential growth when it comes to the U.S. military's operations in Africa. You know, when U.S. Africa Command, the umbrella organization for U.S. military activity on the continent, when it began operations back in 2008, it inherited 172 missions, activities, programs, exercises across the continent. By 2013, the combined total of all U.S. activities on the continent reached 546. In 2014, that number leapt to 674. So U.S. troops were carrying out almost two operations, exercises, or activities, from drone strikes to counterinsurgency instruction, intelligence gathering to marksmanship training, somewhere in the continent every single day. So this represents an almost 300% jump in annual activities.
What do you make, Nick, of William Wexler's suggestion that these are all initiatives to actually prevent the U.S. from getting involved in wider warfare and that, in fact, they are insignificant individually?
Well, I think, you know, taken as a whole, you can't say that this is insignificant. I also think that, you know, Mr. Wexler talked about the Vietnam model. I think this is a very it's very dangerous to have, you know, this many troops pre-positioned all over the continent.
William Wexler, you can respond to what Nick Turse is saying there. But let me just ask you, you said a moment ago that these missions in Africa are designed to prevent the U.S. from getting involved in wider conflicts. Shouldn't there be some other goal of these missions other than to simply prevent the U.S. from being involved? What good comes of these individual missions that we can say is of strategic importance to the U.S. relationship with Africa?
Sure. The strategic importance is the existence of the Salafi jihadists on the continent of Africa. What we've seen time and time again is that when these kinds of terrorists, not all kinds of terrorists, we're not in a war on terror, not all kind of Islamic terrorists, not even all kinds of Sunni Islamic terrorists, but these kinds of terrorists, the Salafi jihadist terrorists, whenever they have a sanctuary from which they can act with impunity, they inevitably and inexorably eventually go to external attacks. And we saw that in Afghanistan, we saw that in Yemen, and we saw that in Syria. And now we're starting to see these same groups with these same ideology and the same pressures upon them gaining that kind of sanctuary in places like Libya. And we can wait until they do those external attacks, or we can learn from history and try to approach it in a very different way than the way that Don Rumsfeld approached it. In fact, this is the opposite of how the Bush administration approached it. This is not an occupation. This is not direct action by and large. This is indirect action. This is working by, with, and through others on the ground, people who are indigenous to the area, people who have legitimate governance over the area, and who want to extend that governance over ungoverned areas in order to deny terrorists the ability to commit their terrorist acts. That's a legitimate act from legitimate governments, and they're seeking the United States' help, not the United States to fight their fights, but the United States to help them train, equip, and give them the kind of advice on the basis of our learned skills over the last decade and a half.
But why go in at all? I mean, there's certainly plenty of evidence that the use of American military hardware in Africa has created enormous civilian deaths around the continent for whatever reason. And the U.S. can't be blamed for that, but we do become a kind of supplier with our troops on the ground being marketing agents for an arms industry that does, and many people have talked about this, guns do create in Africa a level of carnage that wouldn't be there if the guns weren't there.
Well, that's certainly true, and it's a huge concern, and it's one of the things that the United States, you know, is extremely focused on to make sure that the wrong types of weapons don't get into the continent, that the right kind of weapons don't get into the wrong hands. And while there are ample examples of mistakes that have been made over the decades, I do think that there are also examples of situations that have worked out quite well. I mean, and most of the countries that you're talking about are not countries compared to, say, Iraq, who have huge budgets for these weapons. Most of the weapons sales that are going to be taking place are through Western governments that are going to be able to, you know, be in a position to help decide what kind of weapons are most appropriate. Now, that said, the issue that you raise is a very important one, and that's why these, the proof is always in the execution for these kinds of operations. Can you execute in such a way that you minimize the downside risk and you maximize the upside potential for the very small operations that you're doing? Even in places like Somalia, for instance, where in the just a decade ago, very serious people really thought that that was going to be the next Afghanistan. And for all the problems that Somalia has, and there are huge numbers of problems, the reality is it hasn't. And Al-Shabaab, which is the Al-Qaeda-linked terrorist group that does horrific things both in Somalia and with its neighbors in Kenya, is not nearly the threat that it was considered to be not that long ago. And that is no small reason due to the work that the United States and others have done, indirectly helping the Somalis and the local partners fight this battle themselves so that we don't have to fight it for them.
William Wessler, thanks so much.
Thank you.
William Wessler oversaw special operations from the Pentagon during the Obama administration as Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for Special Operations and Combating Terrorism. Nick Turris is the author of Tomorrow's Battlefield, U.S. Proxy Wars and Secret Ops in Africa. His new book is Next Time They'll Come to Count the Dead, War and Survival in South Sudan. Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks so much, John.
The growth of cities in America over the last 50 years represents a response to migration of jobs into urban centers. Service jobs have replaced manufacturing. Transportation has become more expensive, further driving people toward the city center to cut costs and escape the roadway madness of traffic and commuting. U.S. cities have absorbed the changes, but there has been an attendant rise in luxury housing. Since the financial crisis, what has been fueling this real estate boom in some of America's biggest cities is cash, principally investment cash, as people from around the world park money in investments with safe returns. That has made New York and San Francisco awash in luxury apartments and condos, which may be vacant, actually, because they're just investment properties. But can you get one of these properties? Do you have several millions? Can you settle for something smaller, perhaps? Stephanie Martin-Taylor is the housing reporter for KQED in San Francisco, and Jamie Floyd hosts All Things Considered on WNYC right here in New York. We put them together to compare notes about their respective cities. In both places, success at the high end has meant real problems for real people looking for places to live.
We'd lived in the Bay Area for 10 years. We thought it was expensive. We talked about how expensive it was. We thought we'd come back here and sail right into something in New York City, and it was sticker shock. New York City is, quite simply, the most expensive place in the country to live, to rent, to own, to afford a place to be.
Stephanie, you're not going to let her get away with that, are you?
Yeah, it's the same situation here in San Francisco. When I moved out here, I had done a brief stint in North Carolina between New York and here, and huge sticker shock for me, too. I had settled into a life in North Carolina and gotten really comfy with the idea of space, and suddenly I was having to downsize and try to figure out what I was going to have to give up. Was it going to be my furniture, my dog, my car? And ultimately, I don't have a car anymore, and that's the way I can live here, is to really cut back on some things that I considered basics.
What is San Francisco going through right now in terms of housing, and what do people think about both the availability of housing and the cost of housing?
Over the last past half decade, the city has added about 50,000 people, and we're smaller than New York. So that's really, if you can think about that aspect of it, we're really jam-packed with people at this point. And compounding the problem is that San Francisco has historically resisted the idea of becoming another Manhattan. In fact, there is a word for it, Manhattanization, that's tossed around from time to time. The supply, even though we are trying to build as fast as we can now within the strong regulatory environment there is here, it's a little bit too little too late in many respects, because just the people keep coming and the prices keep going higher.
And how do you deal with Manhattanization? Well, Nicole Lindler, a young housing advocate in San Francisco, has to live with her parents across the bay in Oakland.
I'm a millennial, and I think across the board, the feeling in my circle is that a lot of people are moving back home. A lot of people are crunched with three roommates, you know, living on top of each other. And it's just not the way that we saw ourselves kind of coming into this world and making a lives for ourselves.
Reality is tough for people in San Francisco and the Bay Area, Stephanie?
Yeah, and it always has been. As I was saying, when I moved out here, I was having to make sacrifices, but now it's just even worse.
Jamie?
Well, New York is quite simply in the midst of an availability crisis. And by crisis, I mean a housing emergency. Our population in the five boroughs is over 8.5 million people. And John, that's distributed over a landmass of just 305 square miles. So that makes New York City the most densely populated major city in the United States, with no vacancies to speak of. And when I say no vacancies, I mean no vacancies. In Manhattan, the vacancy rate is 1%, and that's just because somebody moves out before somebody else moves in. So really, around the business district, there's nothing. And the vacancy rate for the city as a whole is around 3%. So the emergent question is, how do we generate enough housing supply to accommodate all the people we want to live here or who want to live here? Now, this crisis isn't new. This affordability crisis, that's been with us for decades, too. The majority of poor renters now spend more than half of their income on housing. And in New York, we're short by 500,000 units. So even if you doubled the available affordable housing stock, we'd still be short. And that's where Bill de Blasio's new plan comes in. He's trying to create more, not just housing, but affordable housing. That plan just passed 46-0 in the city council. But of course, as with everything in New York City, John, it's controversial.
Stephanie, in San Francisco, what is the city doing to match what Mayor de Blasio is doing here in New York to try to create an increase in supply?
Well, Mayor Lee has made a strong push and pledge to increase the city's affordable housing supply. He's pledged to create or preserve some 30,000 units of housing by 2020, with at least 50% of that housing designated as affordable to the city's low and middle income families. That takes time, as I've said, though, and in the meantime, there's a lot of concern that the existing housing is going to waste. Airbnb sites, the short-term rental sites like Airbnb, are very popular here, and despite some efforts to regulate them, most aren't registered with the city. Some of those units are essentially running as year-round hotels. Also, another innovative proposal from our Mayor Ed Lee is called the Affordable Housing Bonus Program. It allows developers to build taller, denser buildings if they agree to set aside 30% of the units for affordable housing. Now, if they build buildings that are 100% affordable, they would be allowed to build three extra stories. Sounds good for many people, but also our infrastructure is strained, and some people are very concerned that the additional density will create more traffic and parking problems and further strain our public transit.
And Mayor de Blasio's plan, John, looks a lot like Mayor Lee's plan. He's pledged to create or preserve 200,000 units of affordable housing over 10 years in 15 long-neglected neighborhoods like East New York. And in fact, East New York, if you think of affordable housing as a game board, East New York is go on the game board. He's starting there. But people in East New York are worried that it's going to become the next Palo Alto, and you're going to have the Google bus going out to East New York, and Starbucks is going to come to town, and they're going to get priced out. They're worried that even the new affordable housing will be unaffordable for them, that it's going to gentrify the neighborhood, even with the best intentions of the de Blasio administration. That's the great fear about the affordable housing plan, that it really doesn't take into account the unemployed and underemployed people that have lived in these neighborhoods for decades.
Jamie Floyd, host of All Things Considered on WNYC, and Stephanie Martin Taylor, housing reporter at KQED. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, John.
Thank you.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Affordability and availability in big cities like New York and San Francisco are issues for the working, middle, and upper classes. But in a 2015 report released by the U.S. Conference of Mayors, homelessness is on the rise across America's biggest cities, with demands for emergency food assistance going unmet and housing facilities closing for lack of resources. The voices of the homeless speak of life, living, and survival rather than rent, location, and amenities.
This is our, this is the kitchen. This is where this is the dirty dishes. And then on the other side is where, we have the food and all the coolers. And you see the fire pit. There's usually always a fire going, which, you know, provides not only warmth, but that's where we cook. So everything's like a barbecue.
In Seattle, Kara Bernstein gave KUOW reporter Joshua McNichols a tour of where she lives. It's an encampment called the Jungle.
What is having a cat around here?
Keeps the rats away. She's been sleeping in my tent, and I swear I haven't had a single rat around my tent. They must smell her or something. But, yeah, because rats terrify me. I've had the unfortunate, opening my tent late at night, and there being a rat in there, but not with Meow Meow.
Robert Patterson is also homeless in Seattle. In an audio diary he recorded for KUOW, Patterson recounts the night his daughter aged out of the foster system and had to sleep with him and his wife outside. You can hear the cars rushing by as he speaks.
She came to us, and she had nowhere to go. And we tried to take her to a teenage shelter, but it was too late. And Carl and I were living in a doorway. In downtown Seattle, she had to come and stay with us in that doorway for a night.
In Florida, new state rules say childless adults must work to receive monthly assistance like food stamps.
Now I'm having to go out here and ask people for help, just to eat. And that's embarrassing as hell.
But for people needing mental health care who may not have worked for years, that creates the hell that Lucy there is talking about.
I hate it. I hate being out here.
Mild weather in Florida means she can survive while homeless. But is it a life? As she explained to a reporter at WLRN in Miami, panic attacks and anxiety forced her to give up her job as a fast food cook. She has since been diagnosed with schizophrenia.
There's no words to describe it.
In Washington, D.C., 60-year-old Miguel Ellerson was able to get an apartment, finally. He'd been on the street for 3 years.
It's like, going from nothing to almost something. Now that I'm here, I can see actually getting my life back together.
In December, the Rosenheim family in the Dallas area found an apartment after spending the last 3 years living out of hotels in North Texas. Father Dave Rosenheim told KERA that it was tough raising his three children in those hotels during those years.
Lots of drugs. There's lots of stealing and theft and making a living not necessarily in an honest way, and that goes on and on and on and on.
This is not life now. This is not what I want my life the rest of my life to be.
Perry Foster. His address is the streets of San Francisco, a tent encampment in the city's Soma neighborhood. When he talked to KALW's Liza Veal in March, he told her, it's not by choice.
This is just a momentary blip. So with that being said, I'm not out here for the long run. None of us are. None of us want to be out here.
A big thanks to Joshua McNichols at KUOW in Seattle, Wilson Sayre at WLRN in Miami, Armando Truel at WAMU in Washington, D.C., Courtney Collins at KERA in Dallas, and Liza Veal at KALW in San Francisco. Thanks also to the many homeless people who spoke up and told their stories.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI. And Staples, offering printer ink and toner cartridges for home or business printers and in-store print shops that can create customized presentations, booklets, and manuals. At Staples stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
I want to be
That group of first graders from Lynbrook Elementary School in Fairfax County, Virginia, are singing about the joy of reading a good book. The kids' newfound reading skills involve vocabulary, grammar, and sentence structure. But there is a mechanics to reading that kids and adults have trouble mastering, keeping your eyes on the right text from line to line. Now, you can try tracing your finger along from page to page to word, or dragging a sheet of paper from line to line to not lose your place. A lot of people do these things. Nick Lum had been toiling away as a tax lawyer in Silicon Valley when he had an idea about using contrasting color from line to line to help the eyes to improve screen reading. The Beeline Reader app was born. The simple way it cues the eyes to find the next line has been reportedly life-changing for those who struggle with reading, with ADHD, and dyslexia.
Our vision is very good at picking up color. When you're driving down the road, you see a light out of the corner of your eye turn from green to yellow, and you can see that, and you know what's happening, even before you have to look directly at it. The same cannot be said for words. You can't recognize a word out of your, you know, side vision because you have to look directly at it to be able to do that. So we've taken the sensitivity to color that exists in your visual processing system and used it as a hook to guide you to the next line, which many people think they're already doing very, very well, but it turns out that's just your brain fooling you.
Well, I read like a maniac, and I actually do have the experience of when I get tired, when my eyes are fatigued, I miss that next line. I find myself lost a lot. So I know exactly what you're talking about here. It's so easy to lose that line. And sometimes, you know, I have to really work to, okay, now where was I? And as I'm looking at your text here, this is fabulous how this works.
You are not alone. And you're someone who's good at reading.
Yeah.
The impact for people who have difficulty reading is 10x, what you've just described. We get emails from people saying, I'm literally brought to tears by this. And to be honest, I did not believe those emails, the first maybe dozen that I received. I thought people were exaggerating. And then one day I was helping a user install our tools on her computer. And when we loaded the first page with Beeline on it, she literally choked up right there. And I knew, wow, this person is now able to read in a way she's never been able to read before. And she told me, you know, I'm 50 plus years old. I've never finished a book in my life because I struggle with reading so much.
And who is this intended to help? I mean, there are people with chronic learning disabilities. There are all kinds of reading issues that relate to vision specifically. Who is this great for?
This is universal design. It's great for people who are already skilled at reading. The vast majority of people who use this, you know, have a reaction similar to yours that, gosh, this helps me, especially when I'm tired or especially when I've been reading a lot. And it helps them read faster. But it's extraordinarily beneficial for many people who have difficulty reading or for kids who are just learning to read. There's been research done by educators, by literacy nonprofits that shows that for kids who are just starting out with reading, they're not as good at figuring out how to move their eyes through the lines. And they skip lines a lot. Kids, if you ask a second grade teacher, they'll tell you when kids read out loud, they skip lines a lot. And so this has been shown to dramatically increase reading fluency for young children, as well as people who have difficulty reading for reasons of visual impairments or because of cognitive processing differences like dyslexia or attention deficits.
And what specific experiences can you relate about Beeline in dealing with people with dyslexia?
My business card has a demo of Beeline on the back of it. And I remember I showed it to someone who was a middle-aged woman with dyslexia, and she said, holy cow, this must be what it's like for everybody else to read. There's zero, you know, ramp-up time or acclimation. It's just a light bulb goes on, and it's so much easier for them to read.
Now, do you have clinical advisors and, you know, people with experience medically and psychologically trying to deal with these sorts of things? And do they understand what's going on here?
We're working with folks at Stanford University at the medical school in the ophthalmology department. They're doing a research study on individuals who've had strokes or traumatic brain injuries like concussions, and also potentially with Parkinson's patients, because people who have these medical issues often have difficulty with visual tracking when reading. And it can be very frustrating for someone who's been a skilled reader for his or her entire life to then have difficulty reading because of something that is feels out of their control. We're also working with researchers at UT Austin who are doing a study to figure out more about the benefit of what's going on. It's fairly intuitive. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to tell you that, oh, the color takes your eye to the right place. That makes it easier.
Where do you go with this? I mean, can I load this Beeline business on my Kindle, for instance?
You can read Kindle books with it on your computer or on an iPad. We have an app. But our next step is directly integrating this into websites and into other reading platforms.
So ultimately, this would not be a separate product. It would be a feature that you would toggle off and on in every text-generating software, you know, on your computer.
Exactly. It would be built in, and you just flip a toggle, and then forever it remembers, oh, this is you. You like these colors, and that's what I'm going to do, mm-hmm. and that's it.
Well, Nick, thank you for bringing some color to my world.
Thank you so much.
Nick Lum is co-founder and CEO of the Beeline Reader. To see some sample text from Beeline Reader, head over to thetakeaway.org. There's this crazy, tantalizing little legend in my family that some great-grandparent on my mother's side is the sister of some grandparent of John D. Rockefeller. They lived in the same town in Cayuga County in upstate New York. My mother talked about it quite a lot. John D. would visit our great-great-grandmother, aunt, whatever, every year, when he was the richest man in the world. Yeah, but that story never went anywhere. Fun story, dreamy story, but that's all. No secret inheritance there.
This is Donna from Winter Park, Florida. I've been researching my family genealogy for about 15 years. Big surprises? King Henry of France is my 28th great-grandfather on my mother's side. King William of Scotland, 24th great-grandfather, on my father's side. But all these generations and migrations later, both my parents descending from royal lines. Who would have thought it?
Finding the royalty and the Rockefellers in your family tree, that's the mission of genealogy. From Granbury, Texas, my daughter did our family tree on my father's side all the way back to the earliest records in Ireland to 1120, male Fyroc Tuil Flood of Ulster. We found where we originally settled in Somerset County, Maryland, and then sailed to North Carolina and settled in what became known as Tolls Bay area. Nice. Brookings, South Dakota. I came from a long line of Mennonite pacifists. I never realized that my aversion to war was so deep-seated. I became very proud of my great-grandfather after seeing his handwritten objection to being drafted into service during World War I.
Hey, my name is Julie Bailey. I'm calling from the Bronx, New York. It is difficult when you are part of the diaspora to trace your family tree. I've traced the white part of my family all the way back to Scotland, but the part that comes from Africa, I guess I will never know, particularly because our first stop was the Caribbean.
Mary Tedesco from Gloucester, Massachusetts, does this for a living, and now she hosts a reality show on PBS. In her case, research into people's Italian and Italian-American family history led her to found her company Origins Italy, but now she's the co-host of PBS's new Genealogy Roadshow, which is, well, you get the idea.
So about 10 years ago, a financial colleague clued me into a beautiful thing called genealogy. And John, I have to tell you, I was hooked. I went down the rabbit hole and I never emerged again. So this passion quickly turned into my profession. And the last 10 years have just been a wonderful opportunity. And then, of course, to be on this PBS series, Genealogy Roadshow, and share genealogy with America. So it's a true joy for me and my other two co-hosts.
Can you compete with the Mormons, who've done a huge amount of genealogy in the United States?
The Mormons have made a tremendous contribution to genealogy, and I don't believe that digitized records would be where they are today without the contributions of the Mormon Church.
It's so interesting. What did you discover that really led you beyond simply family stories to realizing that this is a part of America's real heritage?
Well, I think every discovery that we make about our ancestors is very important. For me, for example, I love the anecdotal clues like figuring out where the height in my family came from. My grandmother had always told me that the height came from her side of the family. She said her dad was over 6 feet. So I pulled the record from Innsbruck, Austria, only to find out he was 5'5", despite what everybody had believed. So I went back to my grandmother and I said, your dad was actually 5'5", not 6 feet. And she said in her classic Italian accent, well, he looked taller to me. So,
oh,
I mean, such is the power of family lore. And we discover, you know, cute things like that that create new family stories and new family traditions, John.
And your grandfather was a translator for the U.S. Army in World War II?
He certainly was. He was an American GI, and he saw a beautiful girl on the Tiber River that, you know, soon became his wife. And he said, I am going to marry that girl. And he did.
You know, it's interesting that in America, these stories, which are so valuable and wonderful to hear by the children who came from those meetings, but it's you know, it's unusual that they stay in the family. They have to be dug up in many ways. Why did your stories have to be dug up and weren't really, you know, talked around the dinner table?
Well, the particular story that you alluded to, the one of my grandparents, I heard that firsthand from my grandparents. And I think the thing about my great-grandfather's height was just that. She was little. You know, she was a girl, basically, when she left a young married girl and didn't realize really how tall or what the height is of her dad. We see the same things on Genealogy Roadshow week after week. There's kind of a kernel of, you know, a family story that may be true or may be remotely accurate. And then we take that and we discover the real story. Our research team really sinks their teeth into it.
And I love, you know, Janet Mansfield, who had an idea of something, mm-hmm. and you were able to bring it into reality. Listen.
So you came to us with a very fascinating story. You think that your grandfather, Archibald Stuart Hunter, may have witnessed the Trinity test?
These were vague stories that I grew up on. We didn't hear much, I think probably because he wasn't allowed to talk about it.
So I understand you brought us a postcard.
I did. This was from my grandfather, written to my grandmother in 1947 from Albuquerque. And it's the only paper trail I have of him actually being in New Mexico.
Of course, the Trinity test was the first nuclear fission test at Alamogordo, New Mexico. So she just wandered up to your, hey, we're doing this kind of thing, told this story, and you got started.
No, actually, she submitted her story through genealogyroadshow.org, I believe a couple of months in advance. And from there, our producers and our research team were able to locate this story and say, this would be an amazing story to tell on Genealogy Roadshow. From there, our researchers had at it, and we researched boxes and boxes of documents at the National Archives, trying to find out whether or not Janet Mansfield's grandfather was, in fact, connected to the Trinity test.
So is it a spoiler to tell whether her grandfather was or not?
We'll have to tune in tonight.
I see. All right. Very good. Very good. Mark Vigil in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which was the site of your first episode, had a similar story.
I'm Mark Vigil. I'm 30 years old. I'm from Albuquerque, New Mexico. I'm coming here to find out more about my father's side of the family. I know we've been in the state of New Mexico for a very long time. I've heard some stories here and there, but I really want some better detail of what really happened in our history.
Now, this is the category of people trying to trace themselves, you know, back even before the Mayflower. And how did Mark do?
Well, Mark did pretty fantastic. We found some very exciting connections for both Mark and the Vigil family. Whether and how far back their family history goes in New Mexico is really a thing for this evening on the episode of Genealogy Roadshow. It's a great story. You're not going to want to miss that, John.
Mary, thanks so much.
Thank you, John. My pleasure.
Genealogist Mary Tedesco is co-host of PBS's Genealogy Roadshow and founder of Origins Italy. Season 3 of Genealogy Roadshow debuts tonight on PBS at 8 p.m. Eastern, 7 p.m. Central Time.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.